If I say you are a cult, perhaps that's just an easy way for me to not have to look at and understand your beliefs. And perhaps it's a way for me not to have to look at and understand my beliefs.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
I'm not really proud to say this, but Jack, generally in my life, I've been one that's wanted to be a part of the in crowd. I remember way back in high school, I was wanting so much to kind of gain status that I basically dropped my friends my freshman year because I didn't think they had enough status and they wouldn't lead me to be in the in crowd. I just stopped hanging around them and started hanging around and working at and kind of nurturing the in-crowd group, going to their parties, getting drunk with them, doing things that they thought would be cool so I could be in with them. I'm not proud of that, but I've gone to a lot of lengths in my life to not be a part of what I felt was an out-crowd, but be part of what's an in-crowd. And yet, it seems like being a Christian automatically puts one in kind of an out-crowd. All of a sudden, I'm not in a place where people think, wow, that's really cool. Or at least generally speaking, our community doesn't think that. And in fact, the political atmosphere is really against those right-wing, awful conservative Christians. It's kind of become a dirty word. And I kind of cringe at that. And it seems like the direction I've gone in my faith, especially over the last 20 years, has been in a direction that isn't very popular even with the church. And so I find myself in an out crowd being a Christian and then an out crowd as a part of the Christian community. So much so that some people have said that I am part of a cult. And that has really disturbed me. It's disturbed me in part because I don't like being in the out crowd. But it's also disturbed me because I'm not a part of a cult. And I thought it might be really helpful for us to look at what does make a cult. What makes a cult? Let's define that, because I'm kind of coming from a defensive position. I don't want to be called a part of a cult. I'd like to educate people to say, to understand what it is and what it is not.
Okay. I remember years ago, back probably 30 years ago, a sociologist of religion out of Westmont made the comment that how difficult it was to define what a cult was. And I didn't really pay any attention at the time. I just remember that striking me as curious, because you always assume that, well, that's clear when something is a cult and when something isn't a cult, what's the problem? And it wasn't until more recent years that I began to appreciate what he meant and how true that is. That in fact, the fact of the matter is, it's a very vague concept, which makes it very useful for the way that we actually use it. And the way we actually use the category of cult is as a kind of evangelical stigma.
It's a diss on other people.
Yeah, it's this major diss that allows us to control other people's beliefs and behavior. If we threaten them with the label of cult, we can get them to fall in line and conform and go where we want them to go, rather than give them the freedom to think for themselves.
Or at least, as it does to me, kind of make me feel weak-kneed and shaky.
Right. And therefore create doubt about the direction you're headed. because they are threatened by the direction that you're headed in. Mm-hmm. So one way to control you is, and maybe bring you back into the fold, if you will, is to accuse you of being awfully close to being a heretic, awfully close to being a member of a cult.
Or at least quiet me down.
Yeah,
you know,
at least
I better not better not stick my neck out there, because I'm going to get it cut off.
Right. Now, I say that not to say, I don't for one second want to be construed as saying, you know, it doesn't really matter what you believe, go off and have any kind of weird esoteric beliefs you want, and who's to say you're wrong? I don't believe that for a second. There are thousands of ways that we can go desperately wrong, and I'll be the first to admit that. That the, you know, we were talking off the air before this, Jesus said the way to eternal life is exceedingly narrow. And the longer I live, the narrower it looks, as I see how easy it is for people to just basically bail out on what is really important, what's central, what's true, what's vital. They just are constantly bailing out on you. People that you never would have suspected that their faith was not authentic and well-grounded and real, all of a sudden it just seems to all evaporate. They're not there. So I will be the first to admit that the Bible is very clear that there is a straight and narrow path, and how important it is to stay on that. But having said that, that's not really our concern when it comes to labeling other people as cults or heretics. That's not really our concern. Our concern is not their souls and their relationship to God, their true status and relationship to God. Our concern is how threatened we feel, how our world is being, my comfort level is being threatened by you. You're coming up with ideas that if you're right, that makes me wrong, and I can't handle that. So don't go there. Don't talk to me about that. Don't raise those issues. Don't ask those questions. Don't make me in any way uncertain or doubt my position. And so we guard ourselves by attacking your position and saying, well, you're offbeat, you're a cult, you're going astray. I think that's the reality of how we use the concept. And I think we should face that squarely and honestly. But that wasn't your question. Your question was, how should we define it? Before I go there, can I say one more thing as background? And that is, my position, my conviction is that we're going to stay the narrow course if we are radically biblical. And what I mean by that is that we have the courage and the freedom to go back to what the Bible actually teaches, to the apostolic message that is embedded in the literature of the New Testament. Go back to the teaching of Jesus, and the teaching of Jesus as that was explained to us by the apostles, and insist on conforming my beliefs to that set of beliefs that they taught us. Not looking at the apostles' teaching through the lenses of some tradition, or some denomination, or some branch of Christianity, or some school of thought, or some theology, some creed, some set of doctrines. Not really giving my authority over to something secondary like that, but being willing to throw any doctrine that I believe up in the air and scrutinize it and look at it and say, but is that really consistent with what the Bible is teaching? That's what I mean by radically biblical. I think we are not typically radically biblical in the Christian culture today. We tend to rely more upon a set of beliefs that my church accepts, that my community accepts, that my tradition accepts, or whatever it might be. We're more comfortable banking on that than we are on the Bible directly. And there's a good reason for that. That is, I know what my community believes. I know what my church believes. That's accessible to me. That's available to me. The Bible's a difficult book. It's hard to understand. So let me just kind of decide out of convenience. My tradition already studied the Bible, and here's what we came up with. And that's what we believe. I did that. I did that for years in my life. I just kind of shifted the authority from the Bible directly over to these Bible teachers who were teaching me, and I assumed that they were relying upon good Bible teachers before them, who were relying upon good Bible teachers before them, and that we basically had it right, maybe not infallible, but we really basically had it right. So what my teachers taught, the Bible taught. There was a direct equation there. And I was just going to assume that, because I didn't know how to proceed any other way, because I wasn't equipped to go back and study the Bible for myself. It's only been after years of growing in my confidence that the Bible is accessible to me, that I can, after time and effort, have it reveal its message to me, that I really feel comfortable saying, I don't have to anymore equate what some other Bible teacher is saying with the Bible. I can go back and look at the Bible directly and ask, is this what the Bible is teaching or not? And so I feel comfortable throwing any and all doctrines and former beliefs that I've had up in the air and examining them. Now, ideally, I think we all need to strive to get to that place. Not that we can all be Bible students, not that we can all be Bible scholars, not that we can all be directly going to the Bible and studying it for ourselves, but at least recognize the need to do that. At least recognize that that's a valid and legitimate thing to do and a healthy thing to do rather than an unhealthy thing to do. The irony is that we get to a point where if anyone in our midst comes along and says, you know, I want to go back and study this for myself directly, we kind of freak out and we go, oh, they're leaving the straight and narrow path. We're already on the straight and narrow path. And they're actually going to go back to the Bible, like that's dangerous. And we see that as an unhealthy step in their lives rather than a healthy step. And we need to reverse that. We need to recognize that that's always a healthy thing to do. Dangerous in that maybe their motives are wrong and maybe they won't get the right answer. But at least in principle, we need to appreciate how right and appropriate and healthy it is to always examine things in the light of what the Bible teaches. Now, I say that in background because almost every well-recognized cult would make the claim, we are more biblical than mainstream Christianity. That's true. Jehovah's Witnesses are very intent that their Bible is a better translation, that their interpretation of the Bible is a better interpretation, that they are just simply trying to be more purely biblical than mainstream Protestant denominations, and that's their appeal. We are more biblical. In their own peculiar kind of way, the Mormon Church is claiming to be truer, more authentic, more consistent with Jesus' intent. They don't really, ultimately they would say more biblical, but they have a more sophisticated story that they tell about how they're more biblical, including a whole other document to interpret it. Probably almost without exceptions, that any kind of non-mainstream, unorthodox cult is going to make its case on the grounds that it's somehow more biblical than mainstream Orthodox Christianity. So
we've got a problem here.
We've got a problem. Yeah, I'm saying be more biblical, but all the cases that you see are people that end up being what are usually recognized to be cults. Do you want to add to the problem?
Do I want to add to the problem? I'm just kind of sitting here thinking, oh my heavens, that really does make it a problem, because everybody's saying we really have a corner on this market. We really know what's going on because we've done the study. Or at least our forefathers did the study and they really knew what was going on. So, Jack, you're not helping me out much.
Yeah, well, not yet. But to be fair, let's look at the other side of it. How many different people appeal to a nice, comfortable tradition with a long history to it? You have many paths that do that as well. As many paths that, in fact, actually more paths that do that than paths that claim to be radically biblical. I mean, on the one hand, you have the Eastern Orthodox Church, which is probably, could fairly argue to have the longest, the most longevity of any of them, the longest history, the longest tradition of any of them. Then you have the Roman Catholic Church that has a very long and venerable tradition on the one hand, but it's a newcomer, maybe relative to Eastern Orthodoxy, and has some significantly different doctrines, significantly different structure from Eastern Orthodoxy. The Protestant tradition isn't exactly modern, you know. It goes back clear to the 1500s. It has a long tradition. Within Protestant Christianity, you have many, many different branches, and all of them have, by now, at this point in history, a long tradition. Well, how long does it have to be long enough? And yet, you have a wide disparity between Eastern Orthodoxy on the one hand and Anabaptist Protestantism on the other hand. They're very, very different visions of what the Christian faith is all about. And many of those at one point or another were claiming to be radically biblical at their beginning point. It's just a mess, really, when it comes right down to it. To sort this out, I don't think anybody has any prior claim than anyone else to being on the right track or have some reason to assume that they're on the right track. And that's why, for me, the only thing I know is on the right track is the Bible. That's why I advocate radical biblicism, because it's the only thing that we have any basis for any confidence in saying. Whatever else is, you know, whatever else can be claimed, the one thing I know to be true is the apostles had it right. If I can just figure out what their vision of the faith was all about, then I'm on the right track. I need to understand what they were saying.
And it seems like, Jack, I'm on the right track if I'm really trying to do that, and I'm really willing to be teachable.
Exactly.
Both at the same time. I'm not sure that's as understandable to everyone as it might be to you, but what I'm saying is I'm not rigid. I'm willing to hear more. I'm willing to keep looking at the evidence. I'm willing to be found wrong. I'm willing to make it a lifelong project to keep revising what I believe and what I see as true, even if it makes me question the very basics of my life, even if it makes me suffer, even if it challenges my identity as a person, even if it costs me a lot and I have to sacrifice. Am I willing to continue to be teachable, or am I going to be rigidly cemented in the beliefs that make me feel comfortable?
Yeah. And I really think that's the key, is that our belief system becomes a psychological comfort zone, an emotional comfort zone. And that's not where we want to land. We don't want to believe what we believe because it's comfortable to me. If we're really children of God, we're going to believe what we believe because it's true. Because children of God are children of truth. And that's a very, very crucial distinction that we need to grasp.
And you know, Jack, there's a way in which my beliefs are very comfortable to me in a psychological sense, because they have brought about a tremendous amount of freedom in my life, and I look forward to continual growth of that freedom, a sense of peace, a sense of relief that I don't have to work so hard or run so fast. And so there's comfort in that way. And yet there's a tremendous amount of discomfort in the sense that it challenges. The scripture really challenges who I am. It asks me to look at myself clearly, visibly, honestly, with integrity. That's uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And that happens on a daily basis.
Right.
So there's this kind of tension between a great deal of comfort on one hand and discomfort on the other. And it seems like being a believer must have both of those components at the same time.
Right, right. In this day and age, in another age we wouldn't have to say this, but I want to qualify what you said for the modern culture. We do need to be open to reason. We need to be open to evidence. We need to be willing and ready to change in order to follow the truth wherever it leads. So it's the opposite of being entrenched and dogmatic and
hard.
Hard, yeah, hardened in my, fossilized in my belief system. I need to be malleable and changeable and, as you put it, teachable. That's very, very important. In the modern age, we can misunderstand that, though, because it's not that we are unbelievers in the idea of truth. It's not that we are total relativists who are saying it doesn't matter what you believe. You know, it doesn't matter what your doctrine is. That's not what you're saying. And
no.
I want to make that clear.
It really matters what I'm saying. It matters so much that I keep trying to find out if it's true.
Exactly. Exactly.
Or if a piece of it is right and a piece of it is not.
Yeah. So it's exactly the opposite of the modern age. It's we believe so much in truth that we really are driven to find it and to discover it, and we're not going to be delayed along the way at some oasis where we say, this is good enough, I'm comfortable enough here, I'm just going to stay here, forget the quest for any truth. that's the danger, is that it will get so uncomfortable in the journey that we'll just stay at some oasis along the way and not go on with the journey. Mm-hmm. That's what you're saying we don't want to do.
And as a teacher, and you're more of a teacher than I am, but in the times that I've taught, I really take it seriously that I'm trying to teach people the truth. And yet, sometimes I just want to go back and say to people, wait a minute, what I said back there wasn't true, but the groups that I've taught aren't accessible to me. And that's hard for me. That's sad for me. And it was just brought to my attention that something I used to really believe strongly, and in fact, by the way, it's your fault, Jack, you taught it to me, and I was just remembering a conversation just yesterday that I had years ago with a woman who was very upset by something I taught, and I was really convinced of it. And she was not doing very well, and it really broke her. And I think I need to give her a call and say, let's get together for lunch, and or just get together and let's talk about this, because I was wrong. Hmm. And I think that kind of review requires humility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yes. We can't really be students of this faith that we're trying to come to terms with without that deep humility that I have not arrived yet. I'm still working on it. I'm still figuring this out.
And what that does for me, especially in my work, Jack, is I see people from various churches, and they come in with different ideas and beliefs, and I'm constantly having to look at those and evaluate them and see where I think they may be true or maybe where they're not, but keep my mind open to asking appropriate questions and not following along just because the big group is doing it, but be willing again to see a part of the truth that maybe I just didn't have my eyes open to look at. And so what it ends up doing is making me a person that is approachable. And I think that's maybe a characteristic of people who are really trying to be looking at the truth, is that I'm an approachable person, because I'm not just cemented and, as you said, fossilized in something that I have to believe is true just because it's the place on which I'm placing my identity, my comfort, my person.
I can illustrate this point, I think. I remember when I was just out of college, I had a summer internship at a church. It was actually a church here in Oregon. And it happened to be a Baptist church. I mean, I'm not picking on Baptists, but that just happened to be the case. And I was in the study talking with the minister, and we were talking about a study that I was doing in the Book of Romans. And some of my ideas, some of the things I was finding, some of the things I was looking at. And I was considering a point of view that was inconsistent with Baptist doctrine. And he listened to me very graciously and politely and kindly. He was a very kind person. But it came to a point in the conversation, I don't remember exactly how the conversation got here, but I said, well, you know, what if such and such is true? And he said, well, if I were to believe that, I wouldn't be a Baptist. And it just struck me at the time, because I already at that point in my life, I had modeled for me a kind of openness and not quite so entrenched, not quite so rigid. And it just never occurred to me that anyone would actually want to actually think that way. I mean, I knew that there were people who were entrenched and ossified in their beliefs, but he was an intelligent, open, kind, reasonable, gracious man. But even he was at a point where he had a vested interest in being a Baptist. And he really saw that he was kind of bound in, he was kind of constricted, that if he followed the truth too far, the truth might take him out of Baptist mainstream orthodoxy, and then what? He's a pastor of a Baptist church. What, would he have to resign? Would he get kicked out? Would he get fired? I mean, there was a lot at stake here for him. And I can't speak for him. I don't know what was really going on in his mind, but at least I recognized what a temptation denominationalism, with all of its institutions, puts on people to not think too hard and too long, because you'll step you'll think yourself right out of a job, for example. You'll think yourself right out of your status quo, right out of the position that you're in. And it just occurred to me, I really kind of felt compassion because I realized I don't really have anything at stake here. I'm just a summer intern. I can think whatever I want to think, and I'm going to go on with my life. Here's a man who's given his life to this denomination. Does he have the liberty to think too far here? And I realized, this gets really complicated. Ideally, as a people, as a whole community, we would give one another the freedom to think long, to think hard, and to think truly, to think to the end of the journey. But unfortunately, we've established institutions and communities and expectations and boundaries for one another as a community that actually prohibit us thinking too long and too hard. And that's the tragedy of the situation that we find ourselves in, is everything is arrayed against us thinking. It doesn't support us in thinking, it's against us. I mean, those people who accuse you of being in a cult, what are they doing except erecting some boundaries around you and saying, Christine, I've drawn a line here. You can't go over that. I don't like it when you go over that boundary, so don't do it. I'm going to call you names if you do.
Well, I think that on one hand, it's okay for someone to call me to say that I'm in a cult if they also have some kind of an argument.
Yes.
But right. Just to name call,
right,
which this is very hurtful. And it doesn't take courage. It seems like if we're going to call somebody a cult, we need to really understand what it is we're talking about and have the courage to approach somebody in a kind and respectful manner. We should do that with anyone.
Right. The only question I have is whether you can make an argument for someone being a cult and not have it be name-calling. Because, you know, I look at certain Protestant denominations and some of their beliefs, and then I look at the Jehovah's Witnesses, and I think they're both wrong. I mean, in certain doctrines that they hold. And I think that they're both potentially very dangerous. And I think both of them could be motivated by a kind of self-serving evil that makes that doctrine attractive. And from where I sit, I don't see any either as more dangerous than the other. They're both dangerous. And yet one is popularly considered a cult, and the other is considered a respectable denomination. Why?
Boy, Jack, are you getting yourself into trouble right now?
Well, maybe so. I mean, I used to be very comfortable with that distinction. Mm-hmm. But now I recognize that there's a lot of ways we can make theological mistakes that are innocent, you know, that are really basically not evilly motivated. It's just this is hard to sort things out, and we make mistakes along the way. And other mistakes that we make that are grounded in the evil of the human heart, and they happen both inside and outside respectable Christianity. Mm-hmm. And for us to pretend otherwise, I think, is really, that's what's dangerous, is for us to pretend that as long as I remain in a respectable, non-cult denomination, I'm okay. I'm okay? I knew all kinds of people in respectable denominations that are not okay at all. So I cease to see any real functional value in the distinction between the cult and the respectable denomination other than just its sociological value in name-calling. I don't know that it really has any value beyond that.
So you never see a place for us to call any particular sect a cult?
Well, maybe that's going too far. I think that there probably really is a category that is kind of out there in a way that deserves our notice and our attention, and I can define that. But I think what I want to say is it happens both inside and outside respectable denominations. And we need to be aware of that, I think.
Okay, it happens. What happens?
The phenomenon that we need to pay attention to, that maybe we could use the word cult to describe it.
Now you lost me, Jack. I guess what I was hearing you say, can I try and define it?
Yeah, okay.
You're saying it's very easy for us just to make a blanket statement about another group of people who have different beliefs than us and say they're wrong and I'm right. What I need to do is have the willingness to say, I'm really looking for the truth, but I'm probably limited in my vision. Hopefully this other group is looking for the truth, but they're limited perhaps in their vision. And instead of throwing a name at them that's hurtful, maybe I can look at clearly where I think they're doing justice to the Bible and where they're not. And that would be the standard that I use, rather than my own denominational glasses to look through, or my cultural prejudice to look through, but looking at the bottom line, does this look biblical to me or doesn't it?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Now, are there some movements or some phenomena within Christian culture that are so manifestly founded in something evil and wrong that it's a tip-off that something drastically wrong is going on there, and thus cult might be an appropriate way to describe it? Yeah, I think so, and let me define that. You sometimes find movements that are based on a kind of authoritarian structure, a leadership that is obviously involved in a kind of ego trip, a self-serving kind of, self-aggrandizing kind of leadership role within that group, such that our theology, our religion, our faith is centered in me, the leader, in some significant way. Okay, that is a phenomenon that happens. And when that phenomenon happens, there's something drastically wrong at the very foundation of what's going on there.
And the names that come to mind for me are pretty radical, like Moon, like Jones.
Yeah, Jim Jones, who invited everybody to drink the poison-laced Kool-Aid just for his sake. You know, that was completely self-serving. Their whole faith and religion and belief system was centered in him as a person. And he obviously got something out of the power and authority and centrality that he played in their lives. No Bible teacher, no servant of Jesus, I mean, not even the apostles viewed themselves as being central in the lives of other people. They were always pointing to the one who was central. It was Jesus. And that they saw their function as telling the truth about how your life can be centered in the person of Jesus. It's possible for me to claim to be serving Jesus and centering you in Jesus, but really, in fact, be centering you in my life, putting me central in your life. And whenever we see that happening, whether blatantly or subtly, there's something desperately wrong there. And maybe the word cult is an appropriate word to use when describing that kind of phenomenon. Because this is not about truth, this is not about faith, this is not about the gospel, this is about me attaching people to me. That's a whole different thing. We're in a whole different ballpark from actual biblical Christianity when that's going on.
This is about me wanting my ego to be standing out in front of the whole crowd and to have it patted all the time, have it aggrandized all the time, and maybe using the Bible as a tool to lead people in the direction of me.
Right. Let me give an example. Now, this is a movement that no one would have ever called a cult, because it was as orthodox as could be, as orthodox and as accepted and as culturally respected as anything in evangelical Christianity could be. It's a man who was trained at Dallas Seminary, trained in their mode of exegesis, in their view of the Scripture, in their view of the authority of the Scripture, had a very orthodox Christian doctrine, I mean, as orthodox as could be, and by that I mean believed in the deity of Jesus and in the Trinity and everything that we associate with being mainstream, bare-bones orthodox Christianity. But over the course of time, I heard a tape of a teaching by this man toward the end of his career, and I knew a man who had gone to one of his services and who was kind of explaining how this whole thing developed. He had been in the military. He came in to teach the Bible dressed in full military regalia, in his uniform, his medals and everything. Had the two American flags beside the podium, and marched into military march up to the podium, then proceeded to teach in his own unique manner, which involved parsing every Greek verb, delving into the grammatical details of the text, you know, whether it was relevant to any point or not, you know, mostly to snow people with his knowledge of the mechanics of Greek, which is a fallacy that happens over and over again. There are a lot of people who know the mechanics of Greek, but they don't know the first thing about language and how it works and what it means and how it communicates. So they get very little right about what the Bible is saying, but they sure know a lot of Greek, and they snow you with the Greek in order to try to impress upon you how much they need you, how much they should trust you because of your superior knowledge of the original Greek language of the New Testament. Now, I say that as someone who does study in the Greek New Testament. I know how important it is on the one hand. On the other hand, I know how irrelevant it is to most people to parse a verb for them. I mean, why? Why would I ever do that in a message? They don't need that. They need to know what it means, not how much I know about Greek. So it always makes me suspicious when someone goes into the details of the Greek text. Why are they doing that? For whose benefit is that? So that was his normal teaching method. But the thing that really caught my attention is at one point during the tape, and you have to reconstruct what must have happened in the audience, but this guy says, he stops mid-sentence, says, "You missed that, didn't you? There you go, you had to fluff up your hair, and you lost your concentration, and you missed my point. And I suppose you want me to go back and repeat my point for you and waste everybody else's time here just so I can keep you up to speed on what I'm saying here."
Now, well, this isn't a person that I'd ask a question. He just kind of randomly...
He just observed them kind of doing something with their hair, some woman doing something with her hair instead of taking notes or something in the middle of his message. And he notices that, gets distracted by it, and feels compelled to comment on it. And then he went on to say, "But then, that's really flaky. But then, you're female, and flaky goes with female." Well, I mean, just what a totally outrageous thing to say in any case, but, you know, to put the spotlight on this woman and all she did is touch her hair? I mean, it's an incredible reaction. And I was talking to the man who was there, you know, when this tape was being made about this whole situation. And his analysis was there seemed to be two kinds of people who are attracted to this teacher. Because he's constantly insulting people. Kind of the Don Rickles of evangelical Bible teachers. He's constantly insulting the people who have come there. And he says there seem to be two kinds of people who are attracted to his teaching. People who, can't remember exactly how he phrased it, but people who just want him to tell them what to believe, and they're going to believe it, and that settles it. And
make life easy for me.
Yeah. And then people who like the fact that he's telling off everybody else. He's insulting everybody else.
So I'm kind of vicariously getting to enjoy him telling everybody else off something I maybe would like to do.
Right, exactly. And that's attractive to people, and they're kind of drawn to him. And the point is, this is in the final analysis, this is not about the Bible. This is not about truth. This is not about a quest, an honest search with integrity to find out what our faith is all about. This is all about this man and his ego trip and the symbolic and vicarious role he can play for a group of other people. Now, as I said at the outset, no one would ever, ever have called this group of people a cult because they didn't fit what evangelicals typically think of as a cult because he was purely evangelical. I mean, he was totally mainstream. In his doctrines. There wasn't anything all that amiss about his doctrines, but that there was something very, very amiss about his life and in the whole phenomenon that encircled him. Something very evil, something very perverse at work there. One of the other tip-offs that in a phenomenon like this is how eccentric the doctrine can become. There may not be anything amiss in the doctrine, but there's this inversion that takes place where really peripheral doctrinal issues become really, really exaggerated in their importance within this group. And the things that are basically foundational and fundamental and at the core and at the heart of our faith are kind of dismissed as, oh, yeah, that's true too. Yeah, that's true, but they become very, very invisible and unimportant in the teaching. That's another part of the phenomenon that maybe deserves to be noted and said. That's kind of cult-like. I mean, why would you take what is central to Jesus and the apostles and say, "I believe it, it's true, but so what?" I mean, that you might as well be saying it's not true. because you're relegating it to a level of as such irrelevance and unimportance that if it's irrelevant and unimportant, isn't that just as bad as calling it untrue? When Jesus and the apostles are saying, here's what our faith is all about. This is essential. This is at the core of what the truth is from God. And you're saying it's irrelevant and unimportant, or at least in effect calling it irrelevant and important. That's really dangerous. That there's something perverse about that.
Let's get an example here. What's basic is, if I can bring it down to the very bottom, I'm not sure I'm right here, but sin and grace.
I think so, exactly.
Those are central. But if I have a denomination where I am needing to see a miracle every week or see a miracle in my own life, and that's really the focus that I have, rather than on sin and grace, I've done just what you're talking about. I am shifting the focus from the basics onto something that really is quite peripheral and
right.
Making it what's important, and probably because it makes me feel good. It's got kind of an emotional high to have somebody talk about a miracle in their life each week and to really base my service and my the service in the church on that.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. I'll give you one example. I'll try to make it short because I know we're running out of time, but I had several meetings with a woman who was a Jehovah's Witness, and we talked and we chatted, and I ended up basically dominating the conversations at times, talking a lot about the Book of Romans, but she responded very positively. I mean, just really seemed to be a genuine, authentic kind of amen to what I was talking about, the grace of God and faith in the Book of Romans. And I really sensed a rapport with her. I went away from that thinking this probably is a woman who really is actually a child of God and who really does know the gospel and really does know the truth. I think she's probably my sister in this faith that we have. But I'm not sure she would say the same thing about me, because at the end, where we really parted company was on the issue of whether it was idolatrous to pledge allegiance to the flag. Now, in my mind, what I was trying to say to her is, you know, that just seems so unimportant to me, it doesn't really matter. I mean, do I pledge allegiance to the flag? Well, there aren't very many occasions where that happens, but were I called upon to do so, would I do so? And I said, well, yeah, I probably would, but I wouldn't mean it. I mean, what am I even saying by pledge allegiance to the flag? I may pledge allegiance to the flag until I'm blue in the face, but when it comes right down to it, I'm not going to obey my country over my God. So there's always that bottom line qualification on any pledge that I make. Well, in her mind, the very act of pledging allegiance to the flag is such an overt act of idolatry that you cannot be a true child of God. I don't know if that's the word she would use, but a true believer, a follower of Jehovah, and do that. Well, in my mind, that's an example of where that group, Jehovah's Witnesses, have taken issues that are really kind of controversial and judgment calls and on the periphery, and have put them right into the core of what makes them distinctive. What do I believe? I believe we should not pledge allegiance to the flag. Well, that's really eccentric. I mean, off-centered. It's taking things way out on the periphery and bringing them to the center and saying that's the center of what we stand for. That's the center of what we believe. That's an example of what I'm talking about. Whereas we really need to be able to have that kind of discernment to be able to take what's central and see it as central and understand what's peripheral and leave it on the periphery, leave it where it belongs and accept it as being out there. There is a phenomenon where people bring to the center what is really trivial and unimportant by comparison to what ought to be central, and they make that the central focus of their Christianity and their faith. And that deserves being noted, and it is a phenomenon that is kind of cult-like in its characteristics.
So let's go back and review the points that you've made.
I think simply two, and maybe we could make three of them. What makes something noteworthy as a cult, as the way I would define a cult, is if it seems to be an authoritarian ego trip of some individual leader, some individual, and it has the tendency to take peripheral things and making them central in the doctrine of the teaching of that system. then that's a noteworthy phenomenon that happens often. It happens both inside mainstream Christianity as well as outside mainstream Christianity, and we really need to be aware of it because there's something faulty at the core of that kind of phenomenon. And that's what I would call a cult.
There's not a lot of criteria there, Jack.
No, it takes discernment. I can't give cut and dry, you know, do they believe this, do they believe that? Here's a list of things that you can judge them by. It really takes a more subtle kind of discernment of what's motivating this group. Why is this happening? What's behind it? What's appealing to them? Are they or are they not seekers after truth? I think you put it very well earlier when you said, the bottom line is, no matter how much they might disagree with my set of beliefs at this point of time in our lives, are they or are they not on a journey to try to discover what the truth is and conform their lives to that? If they are, then they're on the same journey that I'm on. They really are fellow travelers. They really are brothers and sisters, even if our specific beliefs right now would seem to make us look different. They're on the same journey, though. And that's the most important thing, because none of us are going to end up believing what we believe now when we see the full light of truth at the end. We're all going to find out how wrong we are at points in the end. But the critical question is, do I discern that they're on the same journey that I'm on? That's what faith is.
And not foolproof, but also perhaps points that I need to look at. Are they people that are humble? Are they people that are approachable? Are they people that courageously look at situations in life and make choices not based on personal comfort, but based on what's true, what's right, what's good, what's loving? Even if those people's beliefs are very different than my own, perhaps God is using whatever route they're taking to bring them to Himself, to recognize His grace.
Right.
And to see their sin.
Right. And just to say it one more time, it's not because all paths are right. It's not because it doesn't make any difference what you believe that there are multiple truths. There's only one truth, and we all need to find it. But none of us are there yet, and we need to give one another the space and the freedom to be on the journey toward that one truth.
Many spiritual leaders promise to satisfy our spiritual yearning for peace and enlightenment. Even many Christians believe that one can be a super Christian and rise above moral and physical limitations. Mackenzie Study Center staff member Larry Barber objects to these claims in his News and Views article, Real Spirituality. By looking at 1 Corinthians and Romans, Larry shows how the Apostle Paul saw spirituality. That is, it's a process whereby the Spirit of God reveals to us the truth about God, ourselves, and the world. It is not a state of consciously feeling closer to God. It is the pursuit of righteousness in a fallen world with other fallen people like ourselves. Please call Mackenzie at 541-485-4801. For your free News and Views article, Real Spirituality.
One of the things the Study Center does is work very hard at trying to find ways to present the gospel to people that brings up questions that are relevant and important to them. There's an upcoming event called Oktoberfest, and I think it's trying to really get at that.
Yes. This year it's going to be on the topic generally of spirituality, a follow-up from the one we did last year. This is an annual event, and last year we explored the concept of spirituality. The reason being that spirituality seems to have emerged in our culture as an okay thing to talk about and to think about. It's talked about all the time on Oprah Winfrey these days. You have television programs like Touched by an Angel, and there's a new one out I just noticed recently that is not afraid to be other than secular, to acknowledge that something exists out there beyond us. And the problem, of course, is you can be interested in spirituality and not at all be interested in the gospel. So we're exploring what is really unique and distinctive and definitive about biblical spirituality in contrast to a more general vague spirituality that is acceptable to our culture.
So you're really going to define it?
Yeah, we didn't last year. I don't know if the papers this year will so much define it as carry on the discussion from last year and explore different aspects of it. It should be very interesting. I'm really looking forward to it.
What kind of people do you think would be interested in this?
Well, mostly believers who are wanting to get clearer on what exactly their faith does say and how their faith, how it is like and unlike all the other ideas that are out there in the marketplace of ideas. But I would hope that people who are interested in spirituality but don't even pretend to be Christians, but are at least open enough to finding out what Christianity has to say on the subject, that they too might be interested as well.
You know, recently we received a letter, Jack, to Christianity at Work by a person who described themselves as a, now you're going to help me out, a Jewish, radical,
socialist. Communist, atheist.
And yet had incredibly great questions.
Yes.
He started it out by saying, this is a letter you probably don't want to receive, and that's a letter we really wanted to receive. It was great.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of person who is kind of fighting about it, kind of thinking about it, really working with ideas of spirituality and or Christianity as they mix, I think it would be a fascinating conference, in particular because the people who are presenting are bright, intelligent, thoughtful people. And in fact, you're one of them, right?
I will be giving one paper.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. You kind of sidestepped that one, didn't you? Yeah. And I think that people would have a really refreshing look, an intellectually stimulating and personally stimulating addition to their understanding of Christianity and spirituality.
I think so. I really enjoyed it last year, and I expect to be equally excited about this year.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the nuts and bolts. What's the cost?
It costs $45. If the registration is received before the 13th of October, there's a cost break if you pre-register. It's going to be held at Grace Community Church in Eugene, Oregon, on Friday and Saturday, October 27th and 28th. They can contact the Study Center with their registration or for questions about it, 1883 University Street, or the phone number is area code 541-485-4801.
I hope that a lot of people are able to go. How many people usually go?
100 or so.
Really? It's that many?
Maybe it wasn't quite that big last year, but mm-hmm. we've had anywhere from 50 to 150, depending upon the year.
Okay. And I think there's some really nice accommodations that you guys have set up. There's some beautiful bed and breakfasts. Are you going to do that again this year around the study center?
Yeah, at least information about that. Uh-huh.
Okay. We hope to see you there.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The Mackenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the Mackenzie staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The Mackenzie Study Center is a non-profit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program
The telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.